Welcome to this episode of 10 Conversations for 10 Years, a series of interviews with people right at the forefront of healthcare improvement globally, celebrating 10 years of quality improvement at East London Foundation Trust and thinking ahead to what the future of this field might look like. I'm Amar, Chief Quality Officer at East London Foundation Trust. Thank you for joining us today. I'm absolutely thrilled to have as our guest today, Steve Svensson. Steve, many of you all know and have met. Steve has a long history of leading the field of quality improvement. He has been a senior leader at the Mayo Clinic in the US for many years. He's led a lot of the thinking and learning and experience in the work on joy and thinking about how we create environments where people can thrive at work. And Steve's a senior fellow at the IHRI. Steve, it's an absolute joy to have you with us today. Welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you for the conversation.
Fantastic. And Pedro and I are going to put some questions to you to harness all of your experience and learning for our audience today. Pedro, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Amar. And Steve, it's so good to see you to talk about so many important topics that are so close to your heart and what you care about and what you've done throughout your amazing professional life. So we're looking forward to this conversation.
No, thank you so much. You're both too kind.
I wonder whether you could just start off by giving us a little summary of your work in this field. What first brought you into learning about and working on the topic of joy and well-being and creating environments where people can thrive? And what have you learned over the years?
Well, part of it goes back to what Deming said about quality and the people doing the work closest to the patient, closest to the customer, should find joy in their work. And so I was quality officer, chief quality officer at Mayo 20 years ago. And the work then was started with, you start with the people that you have the privilege of serving and work backwards. And then I learned in the quality space that if you infuse each of those processes and systems and behaviors and policies with kindness, that the organization, the individuals are set up to flourish. We got deeper into it at Mayo when I was head of leadership and organization development with my dyad and triad partnership, where we first looked at reducing substantially the measurable rates of emotional exhaustion or professional burnout. But we've quickly moved from trying to get rid of something bad to aspiring to something of goodness. And so instead of trying to get rid of burnout, emotional exhaustion, social isolation, we said, let's aspire to be a kind organization that is filled with joy and energy and harmony and meaning. And along the way, burnout goes away and staff are set up to thrive as a learning community.
What do you see as the relationship between kindness as a concept and improvement as a method for solving problems?
You know, it's interesting. When you look at societies and you look at organizations and you look at individuals and then you look at the determinants of what we aspire to as citizens or as employees or staff or as individuals, I did a comprehensive review of kindness and fulfillment and health span, which is a subset of lifespan that is spent in good quality of life. And all the 54 determinants had elements of kindness. So if you look at the top 10% of all of the countries in the world for happiness and the top 10% of all the countries in the world for health span, there are 13 that are in the top decile of both. And they are there because they infuse their policies and their actions and their behaviors with kindness. So they have the highest levels of trust in each other and trust in government. Those 13 countries have the highest levels in the world of social equity and gender equity. And those are the countries that have the happiest people that live the longest. And organizations are just small societies. And so when we focus at the organizational level on the people closest to the other people we have the privilege of serving, and infuse our systems and processes and behaviors and policies with kindness, we flourish. And those are the organizations that distinguish themselves as being the most durable and where patients have the best experience and results. And there are four basic conditions that humans need to flourish as individuals, as members of staff in an organization, and citizens. And this is based on 60, 70, 80 years of research by Harlow and DC and Ryan and Seligman and Bella. So this is great giants have established these four. And the words I use to describe them are agency. People need to have some control over their life and of their work life. And Michael Marmot, the great British epidemiologist, in the first White House study, showed that when people could say about their career that they had some control over their work life, they lived longer. They had low rates of cardiovascular disease and cancer and low back pain, and they lived longer. And so it has, all of these have both physical and mental and social ramifications. The second is this camaraderie, this part of being part of a community and the social relationships. The third is the meaning and purpose of the work that one does in their life and making that connection. I love how Emile Durkheim, the French sociologist, called it collective effervescence. Isn't that a beautiful term? Collective effervescence. And that's the harmony and the energy and the meaning and purpose that people experience when they come together as a group with a shared purpose. And so the organizations and the leaders that are able to bring people together, have them recognize their shared purpose in making the world a better place in healthcare and health, are the ones that are going to thrive. And the last of the four is positivity. In huge epidemiology studies of nurses and nuns and U.S. veterans and a large one did at Mayo Clinic, people who have a positive affect or optimistic have leaders who focus on what is good with the world and how to get more goodness into your world, they live longer and they are more fulfilled in their life and they have longer health spans. So those four elements of agency, collective effervescence, camaraderie, and positivity are ones that the best countries in the world that have the happiest, longest living citizens and the leaders and organizations, when they infuse those elements into the work life of where most adults in the world spend at least half of their lives at work. And so if we really want to have the best life possible, our work life has to be part of that high performing. And of course, individuals have a shared responsibility for this with organizations, and the individuals that choose to be kind to themselves and kind to their neighbors have maximized the likelihood that they'll experience this good life of optimal happiness, fulfillment, and health span. So that's kind of a big picture of how kindness is, I think, what we see in the best, most durable, most people-centered organizations inside and outside of healthcare in the world.
Stephen, this is great. And I think some of the invitations that you're making is for us to think carefully and mindfully about the intentionality of language. One of the ongoing narratives around the world is around burnout and how tough it is and so on. And there's no doubt that things are tricky, but there is an intentionality to the reframing of this as an opportunity towards joy, as opposed to the abyss towards burnout, which I think makes a difference. So I'm keen to build on what Amar has been reflecting with you on, and maybe think about two things, and I'll start with the first one. So what can people do concretely? And I'd love for you to talk about the practice of, and then secondly, about the narrative and how we evolve the narrative to what it maybe could be to invite people into a space of possibility. So in terms of the practices, I want you to reflect on commensality. So tell us briefly what it is and where you've seen it work and why you think it works so well.
Thanks, Pedro. So you talked about the narrative and the words we use, and those are critically important. And the most important leader for all of us who have the privilege of serving patients and families and communities, those leaders closest to the patient and families are the most important, and their words matter, and the mood and the climate they set in help set in the work units is critical, and emotions are contagious within groups and between groups. So if they still have to be realistic, but if we focus on what has gone well and what we aspire to, and call out appreciation and gratitude for the good things, and then get to work on where we're shy of the best we can be, that's the kind of the whole space. And so you mentioned commensality. It's a fancy word, and I love this, of sharing a meal and a conversation with friends and colleagues. And it was first studied in firefighters who spend a lot of time eating and baking and cooking together. And we did 3 randomized control trials at Mayo with healthcare professionals and measured everything from cortisol levels to social isolation, positive feelings about the organization, emotional exhaustion, joy. And in all of these studies with human beings in the healthcare field, those measures all went in the right direction, including cortisol levels in women physicians who were also mothers. So we know it works. And it's such an easy thing for organizations to facilitate. And we've facilitated that we supported meals of 6 to 8 professionals that wanted to get together. Sometimes there were multifunctional teams, multidisciplinary teams. And we just asked if they start with one of several dozen questions that started on a positive reflection of what it's like to be a leader, as a nurse, a doctor, social worker, manager in healthcare, and then let the conversation go from there. So people need the connection with others. And if you look across the planet, the societies and the communities that live the longest and are most fulfilled, they have the highest rates of social connectedness, including single long-term healthy dyadic relationships beyond the work-life community. So commensality is one tactic that feeds into these 4 human needs we have of agency, collective effervescence, camaraderie, and positivity. And it's a program that can easily be started most any place.
Let me just follow up on that, Stephen, since I'm talking about maybe practices first and you're reflecting also on the narrative, and ask you and Amar a question. Amar, one of the most impactful practices that I have seen in the 10 plus years working with you at ELFT has been the efforts to embed practices that can catalyze joint work. And one of those entails listening. So asking across units in the organization primarily 2 questions: what makes for a good day at work, and what are the pebbles in your shoes? And then based on that, inviting each unit to think about how they can do more of what makes a good day, and then how to manage the things that perhaps are pebbles in their shoes. Can you reflect briefly, Amar, on some of the learnings that you've had both in doing it at ELFT and in doing it through the Royal College of Psychiatrists, maybe at a broader level? And then Stephen, after Amar reflects on it, can you talk briefly about the usefulness or value add of listening as a leadership practice?
Thanks, Pedro. I'm struck, Steve, by those 4 components that you described of agency, camaraderie, meaning and purpose and positivity, and the connection that I think introducing continuous improvement as a way of being and thinking in an organization enables all four of those, I see. And certainly in the last decade, as we've been trying to learn how to be more curious and shift the power balance so that it's more in the hands of the people at the point of care, both the patients and service users and the staff closest to them, we have had to learn as leaders what our role now is. And it's much more about being curious and asking questions. The walk rounds is one manifestation of that. And I'm curious, Steve, for other examples of what organizations are doing to change their structures and policies to enable this kinder, more resilient organizational construct. But for us, walk rounds are one way we've enabled this. We do 250 walk rounds a year as a leadership team. And each of those is framed around four questions. And they're really asset-based questions. They're appreciative inquiry questions. Starting off by always asking, what are you proud of as a team? What are you working to improve? And then starting to think, okay, well, what's getting in the way of you doing the best you can? So that's one way in which I think, Pedro, we've tried to reinforce this culture that we are here to listen and learn from those closest to the point of care who have the greatest impact on people's lives and for us to learn what we can do to support them. But I'm curious, Steve, if you've seen other practices and ways in which organizations have changed what can sometimes be really hard bureaucratic structures and processes to become kinder.
Yeah, so I love that practice, Amar, and it's a beautiful way of connecting to the people closest to the real work of organizations. In addition to that, as Pedro was saying, listening as a leader listening to understand is a critically important behavior. We've identified five behaviors of listening to understand, appreciation, mentoring, including so everyone, regardless of pheno or genome, feels welcome and respected in the organization and in the work unit, and transparency. Those five behaviors, we've been measuring those are on all leaders in the organization, from the CEO down to the nurse managers and the physician, section leads. In an annual survey, we asked 12 questions about those five behaviors of all leaders in the organization, and dramatic, durable relationship and causal relationship between those five behaviors and the well-being of the staff, the rates of turnover, the rates of engagement, the rates of burnout and fulfillment. All of those are in the right direction with leaders that live those five behaviors through the eyes of the staff that they have the privilege of leading. So we actually, you can systematize these. I call them their kindness behaviors. These are leaders that care about their staff as a real person and treat them as a real person in the idea of co-creating, co-producing the best way forward. And so the listen, sort, empower that I know Pedro is involved with, and you are too, Amar, the finding pebbles. This listen, sort, empower is a way that embodies most of those five behaviors. Because we're, instead of coming in and say, we're going to fix something for you, we're going to start by listening to understand what are the pebbles in your shoe? What's the best possible day in our work life? And how can we make more best possible days? And then together, not doing something for them or to them, but with them, improving processes and behaviors and relationships so that we have more of those most joyful, rewarding days. So you can systematize kindness by measuring leader behaviors. You can systematize kindness in organizations by selecting the right leaders and developing them through this lens of kindness. And then at the organization level, for every new business plan or venture at the board levels, we say, well, we want to look at the financial effect analysis. Of course, we have to, as not-for-profits, we still need to have a margin so we can keep the doors open next year. When I was quality director 25 years ago at Mayo, we started adding a quality effect analysis to all the business plans after the financial effect analysis, because that's really what we say was most important in our mission, is the quality and safety and service and experience of patients and families. So we should measure it, and we should ask everything that we do or redo or implement, it should we should at least ask ourselves, what does it do for the whole quality experience of patients? And now many organizations have added the essence of a kindness effect analysis. Every major decision organization makes goes through the process of, well, what does it do for finances? What does it do for quality? But what does it do for the well-being of our staff? And does it infuse our systems and policies and behaviors and actions with kindness? Are we being kind at every level to patients and families and communities and the staff that have the privileges? So there needs to be an intentionality of the systems that we have in organizations that reminds us we start with kindness. We start with the patient and family, the people we're serving, and work backwards from there, and mindfully look at the quality of those processes and systems and the kindness of them.
Question for you both, Pedro and Steve. What are we seeing around the world about the transition between in the relationship between caregiver and care receiver towards one that is more about co-production of health together? And as that relationship changes, does that have any impact on how people feel at work? I mean, what are we seeing about the relationship between true co-production? Pedro, you're very involved in this sort of work around the world. Any have you seen any relationship between the development of co-production and people feeling more able to thrive in the workplace as staff members?
This week, we spent time with the IHI Health Improvement Alliance members from about 10 countries, 40 organizations. And the meeting was run by service users. The meeting was a co-production meeting thematically, and we spent the days led and guided by service users. And in the context of that meeting, I walked away with three P's in my head. One is power. So as we think about co-production now and into the future, how do we think about power from the day and time that we start to educate ourselves as healthcare professionals into the time that we become leaders of sorts and realizing that the power really is on the generosity of our patients and service users to let us into their lives? That's where the power lies. And we are guests in that exchange. So power is one. The second is partnership. For too long, I think we've been using the word involvement. And there was a beautiful phrase this week where one of our psychiatrists who was present in the room said, involvement isn't hard work, it's the work. And we had a conversation about the fact that the possibility of thinking about language and how it impacts the way we behave, maybe in the use of the word involvement, it implies that somebody has the power and invites others to get involved, as opposed to the word partnership, which is truly about this togetherness in the making. And the third, which both of you have been talking about today, is participation. How do we open the doors to listen better so that we can participate better? So power, participation, and partnership are three words that I was left with. And from the evidence that we saw this week, in terms of best practices from some of the systems that were present at this alliance meeting, I can tell you, Amar, that there is a dynamic that is a lot fresher, that is a lot lighter, that doesn't make the work any less serious or any less scientific, but it puts it into a playing field where the power is shared, the partnership is deep, and the respect and dignification of the interaction is much higher.
That's beautiful, Pedro. And you really articulated that beautifully with that explanation in your observation. So a lot of this co-creation, co-production has been studied for decades with different names at the organizational level and the work unit level. And so the the work units, organizations that have a leg up for thriving and durability are ones that govern with elements of organizational democracy, and they manage and lead and care for each other and patients and families with large elements of participative management and empowerment of the staff and agency of the staff. And having staff, those five behaviors, they're all about organizational democracy and collective decision making, and first seeking to understand and then deciding as a group what the best way forward. It's the antithesis of autocracy. It's organizational democracy and collaboration. And there are elements of how Mayo leads, and you know, all leaders at Mayo are selected by the staff that they will have the privilege of leading. There's an interesting group in the Netherlands called Bertzorg. It's a group of over 800 teams of home care nurses. There are 8 to 10 to 12 nurses in each of these groups. They are self-governed and self-managed. And the Netherlands is one of those 13 countries that is the happiest and has the longest health span of all the 180 to 90 countries in the world. And these nurses at Bertzorg are some of the happiest people in one of the happiest countries. And part of it is because they are saying, your work is important, and these are the outcomes we're looking at for the well-being of patients, families in these communities, and patients who are staying at home, not coming to clinics and hospitals for the most part. And all we want to measure is their satisfaction and their outcomes and their quality of life. And you can go at it however you want. You select your own leaders, and that's, so they're co-producing this with themselves in an organizational democracy, self-governance model, and their relationship with patients flows out of that in a much more positive way than if the three of us sat at headquarters and wrote down the 17 things that we want me to do this week, and because we know all the answers, and it flips that. And so there are many examples of this co-production, co-creation, organizational democracy, participative management that is healthy for humans. It hits those four needs, and we have major, major workforce issues throughout all the continents of the world, particularly in the West, where I've seen most of the data of not enough nurses and too high rate of turnover. And this is one way to address that, with bringing them into a work environment that they say, I don't want to go across the street to make $2 more an hour, because I love this team and I love the agency and the camaraderie and the meaning and purpose of my work group with this wonderful manager that exhibits these five behaviors and treats me as a person.
What you're really telling us, Steve, is that you know, if we find ways to embed these four important factors, we're not just going to be creating environments where people can thrive at work, but what you're saying is actually we will be creating good health for our population. And imagine the collective benefit if all health systems around the world could improve the health of their own staff, and the impact that would have on their population health.
Amar, I'm so taken by that concept, because in the NHS, and Stephen, you know our NHS very well, we have over 1.3 million people employed. Imagine the echoing effect of the well-being of 1.3 million people in the context of the entire of the UK. What an exciting opportunity here. I want to ask you one question before maybe Amar and I walk towards the kind of final set of questions in the podcast. The question is about the research that you've often mentioned, which guides us to the importance of relationships. So Robin Dunbar, Neocortex, can you talk a little bit about his kind of 5, 15, 50, 150 set of reflections and the importance of human relationships in the context of our health and healthcare environment?
Yeah, so relationships are a huge driver of mental and physical health. And so if you look at the research, if you wanted to, there's one single thing you could do that would raise, that increase your happiness and fulfillment to the same extent as if you had $8 million of personal net worth and also simultaneously decrease your all-cause mortality by 35%. And that's that single thing you can do is having a long-term healthy relationship with another human being. It's a powerful driver of physical and mental health. And so relationships matter. And within organizational life, you talked about power earlier, Pedro. One of the elements of power, I had a class on this for my management degree 20 years ago. And the biggest driver of power, or maybe a better term is effectiveness in organizations, is not your title or role. It's your relationships with the 150 people, Dunbar's top number, within an organization. And so those healthy relationships where you're communicating and listening and working together, you're a much more effective leader if you have those relationships, regardless of whether you're a manager or a CEO or a whatever. The most effective, more important numbers to think about, though, for our meaning and purpose and mental and physical well-being are the 5 and the 15. The 15 close friends, the 5 confidants, those are drivers of well-being. And in our work-life integrated experience, some of those should be colleagues at work, and some of them should be friends and family at home. And so it's a blend of those. And I think it's this is part of this shared responsibility for one's well-being and organization well-being.
Steve, there's been a fascinating exploration of the topic of creating environments where people can thrive. I'm so grateful for you sharing your experience in this field and all of the work you personally have led and have supported in this area about how we can create kinder organizations. Pedro, any reflections from you as we come to the close of this episode?
I'm reflecting on my own feeling right now, Amar, and I suppose it's inevitable to be filled with optimism after hearing the simplicity of some of the invitations that Stephen is making to us, nurturing good relationships, listening better, focusing on purpose and meaning and positivity. These are all things that are, I suppose, at the tip of our fingers. You know, our systems are complex. We have a lot of work to do. A lot of the things that we're trying to do is in the midst of imperfectly designed systems. But there are things that we each and every single one of us can choose to do that will enhance our well-being and hence our ability to impact other people's well-being. So, Stephen, thank you for the gifts that you continue to give us, and Amar, that would be my last reflection.
Wonderful. Steve, I wonder if I could just ask you to give one final invitation or reflection to those that are listening, improvers around the world, clinicians from all different contexts. If there was one thing you might want to leave them with, what would it be?
Well, I really enjoyed our time together. Thank you. I think what grounds me and I'd like to share is if each of us every day starts with the people that we have the privilege of serving and work backwards, we will find the right direction for ourselves and our groups. And as we work backwards from the people we have the privilege of serving, patients, families, communities, then look at every process, systems, policy, and behavior that we see when we move backwards from the people we have the privilege of serving and infuse each of those processes, systems, behaviors, and policies with kindness by deliberately asking ourselves, what is the kindest way that we can do this for our staff and the people we have the privilege of serving. If we do that for a daily basis for all of our work, we will end up with a more joyful and effective and durable organization with people who can't wait to come to work with our team.
What a fitting and wonderful place to leave the conversation today. Thanks, Steve. A million thanks from Pedro and myself for joining us today. Thank you, Pedro, for joining me. And thanks to everyone who's listening. Thanks for joining us and hope to see you on the next episode. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.